Next up on This Week in Law, we've got Jeff Roberts from GigaOM. We've got Bill McGovern from the University of Minnesota. He's a professor there. Evan Brown and me, we're going to talk about Pandora and Pink Floyd, Vine and hip-hop, Kindle Worlds, and much, much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is 12, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown. Episode 217, recorded June 28, 2013. Apples, oranges, kumquats, and guinea pigs. This Week in Law is brought to you by ShareFile by Citrix. Enhance your workflow. Send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile by Citrix. Try ShareFile today. For a 30-day free trial, go to ShareFile.com, click the radio microphone, and enter TWiL. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. We're so excited that you've joined us here today because we've got an amazing panel and some great topics to discuss, all things at the intersection of technology and law. Joining us from GigaOM and Paid Content is Jeff Roberts. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Denise. Nice to be here.
Great to have you back on the show. Jeff is one of my favorite folks out there writing about law and technology stories right now, and he has been writing up a storm lately, and we're going to have him unpack a lot of the stuff he's been writing about lately for us here on the show today, and we're going to try and contribute some insights of our own and some questions, certainly. So, Jeff, thanks for covering all this great stuff. We can't wait to get to it.
Same here.
And joining us from the University of Minnesota School of Law is Bill McGovern. Hello, Bill.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Doing great. It's a warm summer day in Minnesota.
That's fantastic. We're happy to hear it. Bill teaches information law there and pays attention to all the same kinds of issues and stories and topics that we cover here on This Week in Law. So we're thrilled to have your professorial point of view today.
Well, it's great to be on. I've watched the show a bunch myself, so it's fun to be on this end of it.
Oh, that's fun. Always good to know that. Evan Brown in Chicago, Illinois, from the Info Law Group, is joining us as well. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Denise. Great to see you today. Looking forward to our conversation.
Me too. Let's start. We've got a lot of entertainment stuff this week, so let's start there. Well, our default rule on the show is to always lead with porn. I think in the absence of any porn stories, we have to always lead with Pink Floyd when that's an option.
Yeah, great idea.
Yeah. It's funny that it's Pink Floyd having this debate with Pandora about royalty rates right now because they of all bands seem to have this timeless capacity. I mean, you could probably pull out the Stones and Led Zeppelin, but I think generation after generation of folks really appreciate their show, and they get a lot of radio airplay on all kinds of outlets. So they're definitely someone who can carry the banner for musicians out there, even though their heyday arguably was some time ago. Jeff, why don't you tell us their take on what Pandora is doing?
Pink Floyd sort of shot across the bow of Pandora this week with a surprise editorial in the USA Today that said that Pandora is out to rob musicians 85% of their income, because Pandora has sent out a letter to various bands or the whole musical community saying, hey, let's discuss royalties. Pink Floyd, newly reunited just for this, said, no, this is a trick. They're out to rob you. Stop it. So that's sort of the background of it. But this is just sort of the surface of a deeper copyright fight. As Pandora grows in popularity, it's basically an internet service that lets you have a radio station. And they, you know, it's supported by advertising primarily, a little bit of subscription. But Pink Floyd is leading a charge on behalf of other musicians and on behalf of the RIAA, the industry lobby group, to force Pandora to pay more, or at least not to pay less. Because right now, Pandora is putting a lot of money in Congress to pay lower royalties. They want to pay the same as terrestrial radio stations or as satellite ones like Sirius XM. And if that all sounds complicated, it's because it is.
Well, I love this quote from your piece. This episode is just the latest flare-up in a long-running rumble over royalty rates in the digital age. This should mean a sober debate on economics and policy, but this is the music industry, so instead we get lies, invective, and propaganda from all sides. So it is difficult to cut to the chase and see what's going on, but you've done a really nice job here in your piece at GigaOhm about, you know, the various points, what's going on, who's saying what, and what does it all mean? And the legislation, I think, is an interesting point to hone in on, because I think it was earlier this year and definitely last winter when Pandora was very vocal about the Internet Radio Fairness Act and was doing a lot of PR around that and trying to encourage people to think about the fact that internet radio should not be treated so much more severely from a royalty standpoint than terrestrial radio. But that has kind of gone to sleep for the time being, hasn't it?
It went to sleep in December, and mm-hmm. the musicians proclaimed a victory, but I sense why you're seeing that USA Today column from Pink Floyd is because it's going to come storming back to the new Congress. It had a lot of support last time around. It's just the clock ran out. They introduced the bill too late in the cycle. I predict it's going to be back. It's got a lot of support. And so basically, here we go again.
So cutting through some of the invective bill, do you sense that we're on the verge of kind of normalizing the whole Byzantine radio rate law and regulation scheme, or is that going to persist?
Yeah, I got a short answer for that question. No. I
mean, yeah.
It's so complicated. I mean, Jeff just really gave the bare bones basics of it. I mean, there's also differences between compensation for songwriters versus performers. There's the crazy thing Pandora did a couple of weeks ago where they bought themselves a terrestrial radio station to try and qualify for a different treatment. So the problem is that these rules haven't had any kind of a comprehensive redo. And as different technologies have been added, they've just been kind of amended on the fly instead of really thought, you know, rethought from the beginning. Congress is having some hearings, but what's going to happen is there's going to be some kind of narrow fix for this particular problem. Maybe the one Pandora wants, maybe the one Pink Floyd wants, maybe a compromise. But it will still just be a change for this problem, and it'll leave the whole tangled mess in place until we, you know, have the bravery to really rewrite the whole copyright law, which I don't see in the near term.
So you're not optimistic about the copyright reform advocates who are being vocal in Washington right now?
I'm optimistic that they can make some improvements in some specific problems. So this music royalty mess is one of the specific problems. Orphan works is a problem. Maybe some stuff about search. But I think I'm not seeing like what happened in the 1970s, where Congress is going to sort of roll up its sleeves and start thinking about the whole thing put together. And at least not right away. I mean, if they did, it would take a bunch of years. It wouldn't be something that was coming real soon. That's my sense.
Evan, I think my take on this over the years, and of course this has been a problem that has been evolving and unfolding for decades now, but my take on it has been somewhat affected by my being a parent, I think. I look at this situation and I see a bunch of little kids trying to have their own way. And no one has come in yet and, you know, leveled the playing field and said, okay, here's what's going to be fair. You know, you do one thing and here's the consequence. And it doesn't matter if you do it in the front yard or the backyard. Or do you kind of feel that way too?
Well, sure. And I think we've observed this before in talking about issues like this. You know, when you have models, business models and participants that are incumbents in the market space, they're certainly going to be very protective of those interests. And that's what makes it surprising that Pink Floyd is taking a position like this, because historically they, at least musically and creatively, and I don't know a whole lot about their business savvy over the years since the 60s and 70s when they, you know, were arguably in their best days. You know, I don't know about all that, but they've always been innovative, you know, from a creative and aesthetic sense. And so it's interesting to see them now kind of making this bellyaching argument about Pandora and streaming music in general, and kind of harping on the fact that there could be some unfairness here and that Pandora is wanting to do a disservice to creative people. At the same time, it's not all that surprising that Pink Floyd might take a position like this, because after all, you know, their music really doesn't lend itself well to distribution through a model like Pandora, which is a song by song, you know, way of distributing music. You know, they have these long concept albums, and, you know, sure, there are hits like Another Brick in the Wall and Money and Learning to Fly and all that stuff that everybody recognizes, but those are all parts of larger works that, you know, could very well be driving but you know, what one of the things that it's really kind of the creative origin or the place where this creativity comes from that Pink Floyd exhibits in a model like this is very disruptive to that, even though nominally it's innovative. So to get back to your original point, Denise, yeah, sure, there are different interests that are clamoring here, and who really is it? Who would it be that's going to come and level the playing field and make it all right? Are we supposed to say Congress with all the lobbying that goes on and all the, you know, the unfair, well, whatever, you know, all that stuff of, you know, lobbying and corruption and all that stuff. We don't want to go necessarily into the weeds that much on that. But, you know, I think we're dreaming, if we're going to be so optimistic, that the somebody is going to come in and level the playing field without it being some kind of cooperation on settling all of these various interests.
Yeah, and one of my fellow law professors at the University of Michigan, Jessica Littman, has written a book and a bunch of articles kind of looking at the history of the last copyright law and how much lobbying and stuff was happening when that was going on in the 1970s. And then you didn't have nearly as much money at stake. You didn't have as much new technology. I mean, the photocopier was coming into kind of wide use and people were nervous about that, but nothing as disruptive as what you see now. And I don't think we do have members of Congress who I see as sort of leaders on these kind of intellectual property issues, but they tend to be portrayed as allied with one side or the other. You know, they're someone who's friendly with Silicon Valley or friendly with Hollywood or whatever it might be. And there were a couple of members of Congress in the 70s, people who weren't household names unless you're a copyright geek, but who kind of took on the job of trying to be what you're thinking of as the grown-ups and mm-hmm. get everybody to the table together and kind of cut through some of it and become really expert in the issues. I don't see people who are well positioned to take that role on, and there's so much more lobbying and money I think it would be hard for them to do now.
Yeah, I think it's a shame because if I can jump in for a sec, Denise.
Yeah, please.
I like what Bill was saying earlier. We need to have this discussion at a broad level, because what we're talking about is how do we fund and subsidize the arts and musicians? That's what this is about. But it's devolved into these sort of petty catfights, and the legal intricacies are complicated. But what this comes down to, in essence, is how are we going to use the copyright regime to ensure that, you know, musicians can get paid and we pay for the arts? But in doing so, too, I think we're at a critical juncture, because all the old revenue from CDs and records is gone, and the new revenue hasn't come in yet from Pandora, from iTunes. But I think it's coming. You look at YouTube. I went to watch Pink Floyd on YouTube, but I had to watch an ad. So all that money is going to come pouring in. Alas, I think, as Bill said, it's just going to be a piecemeal catfight over one shred of it, when what we should be doing as a country is stepping back and assessing what's the best way to use copyright and other regulatory mechanisms to fund music and other forms of the arts.
Okay, let's unpack that a little. First of all, can you explain, Jeff, how Pink Floyd and other artists are taking a position that a radio station should be treated differently, whether it is you know, traditional terrestrial radio, satellite radio, or internet radio. What sort of foundation do they have for the argument that those aren't all the same thing, just using different media?
I think the way you distribute a song shouldn't really matter. I mean, it's the same thing, but since it's become a political question and a cash grab at whatever era it is, I think SiriusXM negotiated maybe 10 years ago, got their price. The terrestrials negotiated before that and don't have to pay any performance rights. So I don't see a lot of rationality to the way the funding system is set up. And Pandora has countered, and I think this is a good point, when they talk about a spin, which is playing a song, if we want to play Wish You Were Here or Another Brick in the Wall on FM, thousands or millions of people are going to hear that. If you want to spin it on Pandora, maybe just me and my cat are going to hear that because it's being played at sort of discrete levels all over the place. So.
Right.
I'll be careful talking about your cat because that might be a higher royalty rate if other ears are hearing it. So just be careful with that.
Right.
Well, that is a good point about Pandora, is it sort of has taken over the elevator music industry, I would think, you know, that people run Pandora in their businesses and in their yoga studios. I know that my yoga teacher loves to play Pink Floyd during classes and goes really well with the kind of yoga he teaches. but, you know, I have no idea if Pink Floyd and other artists are, you know, even catching on to the point that there is a public performance aspect of that where people are using Pandora in a commercial way. I'm sure the terms of service probably have something to say about that. But Jeff, have you looked at that issue?
I haven't heard it in regards to Pandora, but I mean, we know very well the RIAA goes around to bars and, you know, nightclubs or dance clubs or even fitness clubs, anywhere they're playing music. I'm sure the lawyers will be showing up soon. So I don't think they're really going to care if it's Pandora or FM or a cassette tape. But I mean, that's that particular performance, right? It's just, that's the public performance. In terms of what Pandora has to pay, I think Bill alluded to it earlier, is Roger Waters, who wrote the songs and also sang some of them, will be being paid twice on Pandora because he gets a songwriter royalty, but also he gets the performer royalty. Same with the studio musicians. Whereas on terrestrial radio, AM, FM, the only person who gets paid is the songwriter, which also seems a bit irrational because, you know, the way copyright's set up is to put it somewhere and then divide the pie up. But so there's these weird inconsistencies, and the whole thing should be revisited, you know, holistically. But alas, I'm a bit skeptical that's going to happen.
Bill, a second ago, Jeff put YouTube and its ad compensation economic model into the mix here with Pandora and radio stations and royalties. Are those two things apples and oranges, or should we be thinking about those things side by side?
Well, both, right? I mean, I'm with Jeff. I think it would make more sense to kind of put everything that is every revenue stream that's potentially available into the mix when thinking about copyright, because the goal is supposed to be to make sure that we have the kind of compensation that's going to keep music getting made and getting distributed. As it happens, the copyright compensation system now is apples, oranges, pears, kumquats, whatever, because every different type of medium has these own specialized rules, often the result of industry-specific negotiation. You know, I tell my students about one of the rules. There's several, but one of the rules that allows for cover songs to be made under compulsory licensing structures. It was basically a sop to the player piano industry when it first came into being. When player pianos started and the people who made those rolls of music that run through them in the really early 20th century, there was a big copyright fight about that. This was that disruptive technology of the time. And what did Congress do? They went in and made a special player piano rule. And as technology changed, we were still stuck with this rule that makes not very much sense for the current environment, but that's how it tends to develop.
Bill, how do you think, you know, we're talking about three different kinds of radio stations, YouTube, and then there's another species of beast out there, the sort of user-programmed radio station. I'm not thinking
Spotify.
Spotify, kind of. But I'm thinking about now. There's one particular site that IRC will have to remind me what it was. Something.fm, where you could go and go into a room and someone would be DJing and picking out the music that you're hearing, and groups of people could listen that way. And of course, those sites have their own licensing and royalty kinds of battles to fight, but they are just kind of another species of radio station, except for instead of the Music Genome Project putting together things that people select by doing thumbs up on a song or an artist, it's individuals DJing stations for each other on the web. How do you think they fit into this whole calculus?
Well, I mean, it's a different licensing arrangement, because that's
Turntable.fm, that's right.
Turntable.fm.
The IRC, yeah.
So I don't know that specific site, but I'd imagine that they have to be licensing differently than straight up streaming would, because, you know, more like what Spotify has to do for licensing, because there's a conceptual difference in copyright between push and pull. You know, it matters if I, as a listener, can go and pick the song I want versus just listening to what's programmed for me. Those are set up differently, basically based on analogies to one's more like your record collection and one's more like, you know, listening to Wolfman Jack on AM radio. And those were the two technologies of the time, and everything else gets kind of built on that platform by analogy to those older systems.
Well, this whole conversation is making me just depressed, because the odds of Congress grasping all this and putting together some kind of legislation that says, okay, a spin is a spin is a spin, no matter where it happens, and here's fair compensation to the artist, and you're all going to pay it, are just so low. Evan, do we have any hope that that can happen?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how it would shake out, but I think we should just be optimistic that it will, if we look at a long view of history and see how there are strains that are put on legal regulation when new technologies come about. And granted, music is kind of an interesting situation, perhaps a little bit different than the way other technologies have affected policy, because of how it's just been, you know, put together piecemeal. You know, Bill was talking about that portion of the licensing system that goes all the way back to technology that was relevant in the early part of the 20th century. So, I mean, I think marketplace forces are eventually going to win out, so that there is something that's sensible here. I have no idea what it would look like, but there's no need to be, you know, too pessimistic. Let's try to cheer you up, Denise.
All right, Jeff, do you have anything that might cheer me up?
Play some Pink Floyd and go to yoga.
Yeah, that does always help.
And remember, in the 70s, it took years, right? So it's not like everyone says, oh, in 1976, they all got together and made a new copyright law. It took years and tons of hearings. Congress is only just starting.
All right. Well, we'll let them do their job. Let's move on. Jeff, you also wrote recently about Vine and the music world, Vine and hip hop kind of colliding, and hip hop shaping the very structure of Vine in that various sampling cases from way back in the day had something to say about the amount of music you could sample without having to go get a license. So again, great piece that you wrote over at GigaOhm on Vine hip hop and the future of video sharing. So tell us why 6 seconds on Vine?
I think it comes out of this infamous Bridgeport cases, which at first basically shut down hip hop by restricting samples. And then later on, I think it was the Ninth Circuit case that was about the Beastie Boys, where they had a 6 second flute sample within a song, and the court ruled that was fair use. And I don't think it's a coincidence that that's the length of a Vine video. If anyone's unfamiliar with Vine, it's a company bought by Twitter that lets you shoot these cool sort of 6 second GIFs or mini videos and spread them virally through social networks. So you can imagine the sort of copyright infringement you might induce if you took a 6 second video and floated it through Twitter and Facebook. It could be a massive infringement, but I think it's a pretty strong case for either de minimis or fair use. A source at Twitter told me, yes, that's why they picked that length.
So a couple of fascinating points from your article. Number one, that various senators were making their own vines in favor of the immigration reform law that just passed. And which I just thought was funny that, you know, their people are that dialed in. Yep. I think one of them looked like he was in his 80s or 90s and had done a vine in favor of the law. The other thing, less humorous and cultural, is the notion that perhaps you put out every single Vine video out there is uncopyrightable. Are you ready to stand by that, or do you think we would have a lot of debate on it?
I'm really torn. When it's taken as sort of a sample from a larger visual spectacle, that seems pretty clearly a fair use or de minimis. But people at the Tribeca Film Festival were submitting vines, and they were clever. They were, you know, it's a really funny one about Bambi. It's these ceramic deer statues, and a cut to Bambi, and a cut back to the statues. You have to see it, but it was one of the winners, I think. And the outpouring of creativity that's coming from this medium is splendid. So, I hope there is a way to recognize people who make the artistic ones, but my bigger fear is that if we start throwing around DMCA notices and blowing up the whole thing, it's going to be trouble. And the bigger picture, in my opinion, what we're seeing, we're entering this kind of golden age of pastiches and imagery. Sites like BuzzFeed, we can share, and Tumblr, we can share pictures and now film in a way we never were able to do before. Musicians in the 80s learned how to do it with sound, mix it all up, weave it together, make something new. And now we're doing this again, but with the internet and with video. And I'm desperately hoping that what happened to hip hop in the early 90s, that doesn't happen all over again, where people shut it down because you need a license for any sample. I mean, I think that would just blow up the internet that's evolving right now.
Yeah, I do too. Hey, Evan, this sounds a lot like the conversations we've had on the show about whether tweets are copyrightable. Do you think Twitter will treat vines the same way and just respond to takedown notices when they are put out there without really coming down on the legal issue?
Probably. I mean, because it's in Twitter's best interest to do that, and because there are other mechanisms for fighting it out. I mean, certainly Twitter is willing to stand up for issues of free speech and internet freedom and all this stuff. But, you know, the DMCA kind of presents a special low-hanging fruit for avoiding liability for this kind of stuff. And I think this is a really interesting conversation about, the significance of 6 seconds here. And, you know, I certainly would not be willing to begin to venture out and saying that 6 seconds is the, going to be a bright line test. I don't think you're saying that either, Jeff, in all this, but it certainly is a helpful benchmark given the case law that's here. It doesn't change the fact that fair use is a very specific, very fact-specific kind of inquiry that has to go on. And no doubt that there is content that is creative enough, original enough to rise to that standard of protectability under the copyright laws that can fit into 6 seconds. You can just recite something very short, some kind of short poem. Whenever we talk about this, I bring up William Carlos Williams' poem, The Red Wheelbarrow. I mean, that's something that you could recite in 6 seconds. You can fit it in 140 characters. And I don't know anybody in their right mind who would posit that it shouldn't be entitled to copyright protection. So at the same time, 6 seconds also gives you a lot of time. Oh, wait, no, it doesn't give you much time is what I'm actually trying to say. It gives you the appropriate amount of time to do a bunch of nothingness that clearly should not, be protected by copyright. But, I think that, though our impulse is to search for bright line rules and nice compartmentalized 1/10 of a minute units here to go by, it's not going to change the fact that this is something that's going to be very context specific. And that's how I think we should want fair use to be, because mm-hmm. we want there to be copyright protection that's enforceable. We don't want fair use to be the exception that eviscerates the rule. But at the same time, I think most sensible people recognize that fair use has a role in not only balancing the interests of the copyright holder against the world, but also in fostering this new creativity and being actually a force that serves the very interest of what we, most of us agree that copyright is supposed to do, and that is promote the progress of the creative arts.
That was really well put, Evan. Yeah, I'm going to make Red Wheelbarrow our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. You might be listening to the show because you love it. We come here every week because we love it. But we do cover some substantive legal stuff here on the show, as you might be noticing, and keep you up to speed on the current developments in this area of the law, technology law and information law. So why not go to your state bar association, or if you're not a lawyer, the accreditation body in whatever profession you might have, and apply for a little continuing legal education or education credit. We've got a page over on the Twit Wiki that will give you lots of information on how to do that. And we put these passphrases in the show in case somebody needs to have you verify that you've listened. So the first one this time around is Red Wheelbarrow. Bill, what do you think about all this?
Well, it's pretty tough to follow up Evan's little inspirational speech about it. I think he's right. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's two different issues you got to untangle when talking about this. Jeff's article did talk about them kind of separately. One is, you know, what happens when your short 6-second video clip is taken from somebody else's movie, right? I mean, so that's a fair use question. It's about the movie maker's copyright and whether the 6-second video infringes it. And then the other question is, can any 6-second video be itself capable of being copyrighted? And I'm pretty confident it can. I mean, photographs can be copyrighted. Collage can be copyrighted. So, I think that if it satisfies the other requirement, which is pretty much some modicum of originality, it's a pretty low bar, then sure. Short doesn't mean not worthy of copyright. And I think the Red Wheelbarrow example is a great and poetic way of talking about that.
Yes, definitely. Well, as long as we're talking about pastiches and mashups here, Jerry Ellman over on our Facebook page, which is at facebook.com/thisweekinlaw, pointed this morning to it's called Kindle Worlds, which I hadn't seen before, which is really cool that I thought I'd just mention here on the show today and point you guys toward if you haven't seen it. New stories inspired by books, shows, movies, comics, music, and games people love. It's basically fan fiction for the Kindle that they're encouraging people to write. And Amazon has gone and cut deals with Warner Brothers, Alloy Entertainment. That means Gossip Girl, Pretty Little Liars, and the Vampire Diaries. Valiant Entertainment for Archer and Armstrong, Bloodshot, Harbinger, Shadow Man, and XO Man of War. Hugh Howey's Silo Saga, Barry Eisler's John Rain novels, Blake Crouch's Wayward Pines series, and the Four World Saga by Neal Stephenson, Greg Bear, Mark Treppo, Eric Bear, et cetera, et cetera. So licenses for more worlds are on the way, says Amazon. So Amazon apparently has been very happy with how fan fiction has been selling for the Kindle and wants to have people go forth and make more of it and have everybody, you know, let 1,000 flowers bloom. Everybody takes a cut of the financial benefits of all that. Kind of a neat model, don't you think, guys?
Well, some of the fan fiction people are worried because they are concerned about whether this sets up more. I mean, so traditionally, the attitude of publishers to fan fiction has been ignore it unless they're really harming your brand. You know, so J.K. Rowling lets lots of fan fiction flourish out there on the interwebs. Unless it starts to venture too much into sort of slash fiction that she thinks is inappropriate for what is, after all, a kid's book. Mm-hmm. But by and large, they leave it alone. If it turns out that they can actually make money from it, they might have a different attitude.
Well, that's sort of what George Lucas did with Star Wars, didn't he? He said, go out and publish away. And if we like what you're doing, we're going to go ahead and license that from you and bring it into the official Star Wars world.
Maybe, but the people, and I don't know whether this is how it's going to turn out, but people who study fan fiction are worried that the reverse will happen. That the only way to do fan fiction will be to do it within Amazon's licensed and approved Kindle Worlds environment. And you know, the truth is, a lot of fan fiction is infringing. And if the publishers cared to go after it, they could. This just might create more incentives for them to do that.
That's my fear too. I don't like this idea much because so many novels or so many works are derivative in one form or another. We've seen entertainment companies get increasingly aggressive about protecting derivative works. And as I think, as Bill just said, this could be encourage publishing houses to get more aggressive. And if we look at sort of literature and writing in the bigger picture, what do we make of stock characters? What if I want to write about vampires? I think we can say that's a stock character. I want to write about Punch. That's probably safe. What about a sparkling vampire? Is Twilight going to come and find me if I do that? It just sort of seems like a way to scoop a whole bunch of raw creativity within the kind of under the aegis of big publishing houses. So, you know, I'd rather not see this. I don't see what good can come out of it. 50 Shades of Grey, for instance, the mummy porn book, that started as fan fiction. Might it have been snuffed in the bud if she had to have a license to write her first scripts? I don't know. I just don't see the good that comes out of this.
Let's just be very clear that what Jeff said was snuffed in the bud.
And mummy porn, is that Egyptian?
I don't know myself. But.
Right, okay.
Yes, and there's the porn we were looking for the show. Evan, what do you think? I mean, I'm sort of with Bill on this that, you know, people writing fan fiction are in a legally dicey area to begin with, and it would be nice to give them both a way to do it and profit from it and not have to be constantly on the lookout for lawsuits.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, this is a weird proposition because it does one thing and it kind of serves contrary interests, kind of legitimizing fan fiction, but at the same time putting us at risk, like what Jeff is talking about, of bringing this under the what was the word you used, the aegis of big publishing. So, you know, I don't know. I honestly have to think about this one a little bit further, because without some kind of clarification in the law, and I don't think it should be a high priority for copyright reform to see some clarification on what constitutes a derivative work. I don't think it's all that controversial, but without that, you know, this, we run the risk of having these contrary interests kind of continuing to be at tension with one another. And so for the second time in as many issues, I think I've got to just kind of say, I've got to think about this a little bit more, and I don't know what a solution would look like, but certainly is intriguing. And it's interesting to see that there is a response to what's actually going on in the creative marketplace where people are interested in fan fiction. And that in and of itself is a good thing, that people are interested in creating that kind of content.
I'm going to question one more time, if I may, Denise. Because what I'd like to see Amazon doing, there's some huge irony here, because there's widespread infringement of sort of lesser genres, I guess you call it slash or nasty pornographic stuff that people write and sell to other people on Amazon, the self-published stuff. But there's actually a racket out there where what happens, you go get one of these, just strip out all the text and republish it under another title. And this is quite widespread. And since it's all with sort of more disreputable genres, you know, incest porn, I don't even want to know, but or slash whatever, Amazon's not really going to step in and protect these people, but they know about it. And this is a fairly widespread problem of sort of, I don't know if you call them criminal syndicates, but infringers ripping off self-published stuff and putting it out under their own name. I'd like to see Amazon clean that up before they start trying to claim the fan fiction.
Well, it sounds like Perfect 10 needs to get involved and represent these people or throw in with them, because, you know, it's the same kind of idea where you've got a product that is maybe salacious and not, you know, something that's going to get you put on the cover of Good Housekeeping magazine. But maybe in the wake of 50 Shades of Grey, almost anything goes these days. but anyway, there are people out there that will enforce their rights rather vigorously in pornographic and adult material, as we've seen over and over again. So maybe they'll start doing it on their own, Jeff.
We can hope, I guess.
Yeah. What else about this did I want to wrap up with? I don't know. I kind of lost my train of thought there. All right. Unless anybody else has anything to say about Kindle Worlds. Oh, I know what I was going to say. I haven't looked at yet. I don't know if you guys have the actual, you know, what sort of terms, what sort of compensation the authors would get in this kind of arrangement. So if we're looking at, you know, sort of the traditional publishing industry model, then maybe this is not a great thing. But, you know, for people who might not have had the exposure that Kindle can offer and, you know, might not have had hope of much compensation at all, that this is a step up. What do you think about that, Jeff?
I think it's a start. And, you know, it's fascinating, these new self-publishing distribution forms and the new opportunities. And almost in a way, circles back to what we were talking about earlier about the Pandora model, because one thing we didn't touch on is the amount of new bands and the exposure it gives them. So I think, yeah, perhaps providing a bit of a kind of official forums under a copyright umbrella might help them. But it's early days. I'm curious what this will look like in 10 years.
Yeah, me too. All right.
On
well,
the IRC.
Yes.
Yeah, just saying, on the IRC, I think the Sue has a good point, which is that fanfic writers are not usually doing this with the hope of making money off it anyway. It's a hobby. Mm-hmm. It's something they do for the love of the book and the characters. And so, you know, it's not clear to me that Amazon is going to get, a real stampede of fanfic writers who might prefer to stay where they are in the communities that already exist on these fanfiction sites, where they have relationships and where they're enjoying what they're doing, and making some micro payments for people who buy the stuff might not be that appealing.
Yep, indeed. All right, well, we're going to take a break here. We're here today with Bill McGivern from University of Minnesota School of Law and Jeff Roberts from GigaOM and Paid Content. Evan Brown, my co-host, and me, Denise Howell, and we're chatting about some interesting stuff in the world of entertainment, technology, and law at the moment. And we're going to go back to it to get to the latest in the Joel Tenenbaum case in a moment. But before we do that, we're going to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is ShareFile by Citrix. In business, we rely on sending and receiving important materials all the time. It's what business consists of course. But there's a lot of risk in placing large and confidential files in online boxes or even sending them as regular email attachments. There's no guarantee that attachment will go through, or you really don't know who's going to access your files. That's why we use ShareFile by Citrix. It's the better way to send and receive files of almost any size. Because with ShareFile, you can easily and securely send everything from large documents to PowerPoints, videos, huge transcripts, briefs with lots of exhibits in the legal field. And these files are sent as a link. That means you're not going to get any bounce backs. You're not going to have to deal with the fact that either your email system or your recipients has choked on this too large a file. And you're going to be able to track when it's downloaded and set access controls so you know that it's secure. Plus, ShareFile allows you to store your files in the cloud so you can access them from anywhere. It's a great mobile access tool. You can use your laptop, your phone, your iPad, your tablet of any kind and work on the go. With ShareFile, I have lots of interaction with clients. It's easily customizable so that my legal professional presence is something that my clients are familiar with. When they go there, they understand they're not dealing with ShareFile, they're dealing with me, which makes them feel comfortable. And I know that their legal files and confidential documents are going to get to them securely and safely. And I know when I'm dealing with an adversarial party that, yep, they got it and they saw it. And that's something that's important to know in the legal field often. So I want you to try ShareFile with this special offer. Sign up today and you'll get a 30-day free trial with no obligation. Go to ShareFile.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and enter TWIL, T-W-I-L. That's ShareFile.com and type in TWIL. Thank you so much, ShareFile, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, Joel Tenenbaum, for folks who may, you know, that name's familiar. Why do I know who Joel Tenenbaum is? Joel Tenenbaum is one of the people who has been bouncing around the courts for years in a lawsuit against him by the music industry, basically, for illegal downloading and distribution of music. And he has had various awards entered against him. His most recent bit of litigation in a district court case pending in Massachusetts, that trial court awarded $675,000 in damages against him for 20-something songs. Although it's clear, if you go through the facts of the case, had the plaintiffs wanted to sue him for thousands of songs, they could have. But just to make things simpler and set a precedent that they thought would, you know, be enforceable and would be something that would not be overturned on appeal, the plaintiffs in this case went with, okay, small number of songs. The jury came back with they could have awarded damages of anywhere between $30,000 and $150,000 per song, statutory damages under the Copyright Act. Here they tagged it at, what was it, $22,500 or something per song to get to their $675,000 verdict. That went up on appeal to the First Circuit Court of Appeals, saying that the damages were way out of whack with what's constitutionally permitted. So this was a direct attack on statutory damages under the copyright law. And we've got this short and fairly interesting decision from the First Circuit saying the case that you have to rely on here to resolve this was decided in 1919 and had to do with railroads and the fact that there were some statutory penalties against them if they charged passengers excessive fares. And trial court, you probably should look hard at that case and ignore the 1996 case that dealt with excessive punitive damages, because we don't think that applies here. So that is how things came out, and the First Circuit thought that the $675,000 was not unconstitutional under that analysis, the 1919 case. And I've got to say, Bill, when I was reading through the First Circuit's decision, the first thing that occurred to me is this book. It's been in our family. My grandmother signed this book. It was first published serially in 1905. There is her signature from probably back in the 30s or 40s. And it's called Pigs is Pigs. And it's a case about guinea pigs that were detained at a railroad station and couldn't be picked up by the guy who ordered them because were they guinea pigs or agricultural pigs? And the railroad agent wanted to charge a higher fee. So the pigs stay there and they multiply and multiply until there are thousands of them. And the question is purely legal construction of whether pigs were pigs. And that's, I feel like the court here is relying on Pigs as Pigs to decide this case. Do you agree?
Well, so first of all, if they only had cited that book in the opinion, it might have been a more interesting read than, than it was. So I should say I clerked on this court, obviously not this year, but a while ago I was a judicial clerk on this court, and for one of the judges who was on the panel, although not the one who wrote the opinion. You know, I could have told you months ago this was how this was going to come out. But more importantly, I think sounds like you're not so sure this is the right decision. I'm sure this is the right decision, even though I think copyright statutory damages are crazy and way too high. But this was, I don't think, ever the right mechanism for attacking that. And the reason is because the whole theory, so that 1996 case you thought of, and there are some others too, saying when punitive damages are too high, that can be unconstitutional. But it's really important to say that that's because the punitive damages in those kinds of cases, there is no sort of number in a statute that's a benchmark that says this is how much that you could be charged. It's basically the jury kind of deciding for themselves, right? But as you said, here you've got a statute that Congress passed, whether you agree with it or not. As a judge, that's not your job. Congress passed it. It has numbers in it. You can take out an envelope and a pencil and do a formula to see what the range is that you could be liable for. And that might be bad policy, but it's not, I don't think, unconstitutional. The Tenenbaum's argument was that it was a violation of due process rights. And, I just didn't buy that at all because, Congress gets to make laws. And by the way, sometimes we love statutory damages in the world of information law, even if you don't like these copyright damages, right? What about privacy cases that rely on congressional formula for statutory damages? The whole system won't work if every time it's supposed to be certainty that number in the statute gives you. And the judge can just kind of say, that seems too high, not allowed. I think that's a problem.
Yeah, it does seem that we have courts over and over again rejecting this argument that there has to be some relationship to actual damages when there is a number that the legislature has put in the statute. Evan, were you surprised by this?
No, I'm with Bill. I think the court decided it correctly, although I also, as Bill seems to believe, the statutory damages available to copyright plaintiffs are often just out of touch with reality, regardless of what the proper analysis is, whether it's the Williams analysis or if the court could have been won over to look at this Gore analysis from that 1996, the Gore case that dealt with the due process analysis for punitive damages. I think the moral of the story here is that we, if anything, should be angry at Joel Tenenbaum for taking his set of bad facts and taking them all the way up to a federal court of appeals on this, because the case law that we've got to look at here to evaluate whether statutory damages violate due process is to look at the Williams case from 1919, that railroad case, and we got to evaluate whether the penalty so prescribed is so severe and oppressive as to be wholly disproportioned to the offense. Obviously unreasonable. So that's not an entirely insurmountable obstacle to show that statutory damage awards violate due process. It doesn't say that, that's certainly not saying that statutory awards are always constitutional, but it provides certainly a higher barrier than what the due process analysis for punitive damages awards. But what we have here is a defendant who, arrogantly, admittedly, despite the counsel of several people and entities in his life that should have dissuaded him, he went ahead and willfully infringed these copyrights and just does not present a sympathetic defendant. He does not present himself sympathetically, regardless of what you believe about file sharing and over-aggressiveness of the RIAA and all that stuff. This guy was not an innocent bystander or just somebody who shared a couple songs here and there. He was a really pretty serious infringer for many, many years, despite warnings to the contrary. So there's no way that he can stand there with a straight face and have the court agree with him that it's so oppressive to be disproportionate to what he was doing, because what he was doing was, so right on par with what Congress would likely have had in mind when the statutory damages provisions were enacted to describe willful infringement and the penalties therefore. And moreover, his, the award that was given was only what, I think he said 15%, $22,500 is how many percent of $150,000, the maximum statutory damages for willful infringement. So wasn't even that he'd gotten it socked to him all that bad in the large scheme of things, believe it or not. So I think the moral of the story is to just not take bad facts like this if you're really trying to change the law on something.
Can I jump in with a question?
Sure.
What I'm wondering is, you guys explained it really well, but is this a sort of, I don't feel very sorry for Mr. Tenenbaum either, because he doesn't look very sympathetic, but this sort of award, if it happened to someone else, can it be discharged through bankruptcy? I'm just kind of curious what the average college kid does when they have a $700,000 copyright judgment against them. Perhaps Bill or Evan, you know the answer to that one.
I don't off the top of my head. Denise, Bill?
I don't see why it wouldn't be dischargeable in bankruptcy. I mean, it's not you know, a secured obligation or anything that might be exempted from bankruptcy proceedings. What do you think, Bill?
Yeah, so you say the word bankruptcy to three non-bankruptcy lawyers, we all freeze up, right? same reaction as you, but I'm reluctant to say it because, you know, bankruptcy lawyer will say, oh no, there's this special section of bankruptcy law, which is its own creature.
Yes, so take that for what you will, Jeff. We have a good feeling that it might be dischargeable in bankruptcy, but you know, don't take it to the bank. What do you think, Jeff, about, we were talking about the certainty of damages under the statutory damages scheme and how, you know, that's a good thing. What do you think about the range, though, that's in question here, 30,000 to 150,000, up to the whims of the jury?
It's insane, but I think we've known that for a while. I can't help but going back to this magical process where we talk about all of copyright holistically, and we could revisit this too. My understanding is this was put in the first place as sort of part of a bargain with the DMCA. On one hand, we got notice and take it down, but on the other hand, which was sort of kind of a wrist slap, but on the other hand, they gave the creative industries kind of a sledgehammer by giving them this tool. You know, perhaps I'll throw that back to you guys, but my understanding of the legislative process or the compromise or what due to that, is that correct?
I missed the last part of what you said. Skype kind of hiccuped on you. Could you repeat one more time?
I just want to confirm how did we get these damages in the first place? My understanding is it was a trade-off where they gave them this in return for the recording, the movie industries accepting the DMCA regime. And of course, it'd be nice to revisit and create rational damages again. But I'm just kind of curious, perhaps Bill, you probably know, or Evan, how we got these in the first place. Why did Congress pass such a crazy range?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think we've long had statutory damages in copyright law, and they make sense because the purpose of statutory damages in general is it's supposed to be a number that you can use when it's really hard to prove what you actually lost. So, you know, in some infringement scenarios, it can be hard to say, you know, how many copies of this would we have sold if we hadn't had competition from this, you know, copycat or whatever? So they've always been there. And kind of like the copyright term, there's been a bunch of junctures where they've gone up, you know. The same way the length of the copyright has grown a few times, the amount of the statutory damages has grown. And I think you're right, Jeff, that the last big increase was part of the larger package that we call the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in 96.
All right, let's hit a couple of other entertainment stories here before we wrap up and move into some privacy stuff next. On the Microsoft Xbox One front, we saw Microsoft bowing to business and customer pressure and backing off of its notion that customers were going to have to verify the rights to their games on a daily internet-connected basis. So I think Microsoft probably just decided that there aren't too many people that it was really worried about that were going to fall into this realm of people who weren't going to want to connect to the internet. So they said, sure, we're going to make it optional instead of mandatory. Jeff, did you have any thoughts on this?
I just want to know what Microsoft's PR people are advising them. I mean, this was nuts. They should have known they'd get killed on it. That's my only question. I mean, you know, legally it's not moot, but I don't think it's become a legal issue yet. I just think for my PR strategy, I'd love to know what they were thinking.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I think back to when the Kinect first came out and there was a question of whether they were going to go after people who cracked and hacked it and did their own stuff. And they decided, no, we're going to let that go. But I don't think they ever, you know, took a firm stance, unlike here, that you know, we're going to do it the other way. You know, we are going to come after you. Oh, no, we changed our mind. So maybe it's pears and kumquats again. So
I think the best quote I saw this, one of the analysts told Bloomberg, I think, is Steve Jobs and Apple told consumers what they liked or what they should like or what they should have. And but only Steve Jobs could do that. When Microsoft tries to do that, it blows up.
Yep, I think that's true. Yeah. Evan?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, especially there's recent history that would counsel against this. What was it, EA, with the Sim City? I mean, I think we just talked about that a couple months ago, maybe on the show. Right. So it seems like there would be at least even that recent history to counsel against the Microsoft PR from doing something like this. But yeah, I don't see a legal issue yet unless we could somehow get some information that there's some wacky DRM stuff going on, which I don't know is all that clear.
Bill, any thoughts?
I mean, I agree with everything you guys said. The only thing I'd add is I do think, at least at a kind of concept level, it has some importance for copyright and legal issues, because it's just another example of how these connected systems for using your content end up giving you fewer options to, like, use used products or shift among different devices, all that kind of thing. I mean, this is really familiar now from iTunes and from Kindle, but this is just now moving it into the video game space as well, where it's going to be a connected device, and then they're going to get a lot more control over what you're allowed to, what content you're allowed to interact with as a result.
Yeah, they definitely would be under those circumstances. Speaking of PR...
Not this time, I guess.
Yeah.
Not this time, I guess, but that's what they wanted.
Right. Well, I think, I mean, back to my original point, I think they probably thought, okay, well, most of the people playing on our system are going to want to participate in our online features. We've made them so rich and valuable and worthwhile that people are just going to go there. You know, we're going to have some hardcore folks that just want to have their old games and offline games and don't want those checked on a daily basis, and fine, you know, we'll accommodate them. But most of the people are going to be in that realm where they're under tighter controls because they've decided to participate in the online realm. Don't you think?
Yeah. No, I think you've got it right. Exactly. Yeah. That's the decision they made this time. But the fact that they thought it was worth trying, I think, is interesting for what it means 5 years down the road. You know, how much longer is it going to be? But there are even, I mean, as broadband improves, how much longer is it even going to be the case that there is physical medium for video gaming? And as that starts to really move up in the cloud, you're going to have a lot less capacity to, you know, you're going to be paying licensing fees instead of buying games that are yours to keep.
All right. Well, speaking of PR, Matt Mason, the vice president of BitTorrent, is a bit up in arms and has come out publicly and said, hey, you know, don't be saying the BitTorrent is for copyright infringement. That's not what we're all about. We have a platform. People do with it what they will. There's an article over at Torrent Freak, or I'm sorry, it's at CNET, talking about this issue and the sort of spin that the BitTorrent management is trying to put on the company. You know, don't look at us as the infringers because we're not it. Evan, what's the impetus for this, do you think?
Well, I mean, I guess for one thing, he's got a point. I mean, because it's the users who are occasioning the infringement here, and BitTorrent, despite what a lot of federal judges think, that you can tell in, you know, these opinions, think that it's some kind of centralized service like this. I mean, yes, there is this commercial component to it with going under the brand BitTorrent to provide services that can be used in connection with doing these activities. So as far as, you know, what has occasioned this, I mean, I guess it's just, you know, it's got to be, you know, the recent, I mean, there's always new press coming out about piracy, but I think that there was some recent news about Game of Thrones, you know, big surprise there. There's piracy with Game of Thrones. So some new information about that seemed to unfairly link the commercial enterprise of BitTorrent with that. So, you know, there's every bit of reason for this commercial enterprise, BitTorrent, to want to distance itself, separate itself, especially as technology moves and there will be alternatives to the BitTorrent protocol. I'm talking about it in its generic sense for file distribution. There's something to be gained by holding on to, or at least trying to salvage or even build some goodwill in the commercial aspect of it here. So can't blame them for wanting to clarify the record perhaps a bit.
Right. Dara Kerr over at CNET wrote about this and talked about the fact BitTorrent is increasingly becoming involved in partnerships with music artists and labels, you know, going back to our discussion about YouTube and ads earlier and about Microsoft and Kindle Worlds. BitTorrent is right there, you know, trying to find legitimate legal ways to monetize the service. It says in May, the company introduced the BitTorrent bundle, which builds a paywall within a torrent to enable content producers to charge for files or collect user information. Oh, that sounds delightful. Jeff, what do you think?
I'm a little torn on the torrent stuff because I work in the tech press, and there's sort of a groupthink and an ideology that anything to do with torrent is good and anyone who opposes it is bad. But the reality is BitTorrent is for downloading Game of Thrones. And the same sort of during the debates over Mega Upload, I mean, that guy got rich off piracy, you know, so, but I do agree with Evan that increasingly the BitTorrent system is finding legitimate uses, and it is a bit of a let's not shoot the messenger thing. This is just a distribution platform. It's not the way people use it. It's like blaming people for mailing drugs through the mail. Are we going to, you know, get rid of the post office because of that? But at the same time, you know, I am, not to be contrarian, but I'm a little reluctant on jumping on the rah-rah BitTorrent and torrent-free crowd because they're basically piracy apologists, in my opinion.
Yeah, and it does seem like a bit of their statement, this blog post by Matt Mason, reads like it's from a brief defending themselves against inducement claims like we saw in Grokster years ago. They say, we don't host infringing content. We don't point to it. It's literally impossible to illegally download something on BitTorrent. To pirate stuff, you need more than a protocol. You need search. A pirate content site, and a content manager. We offer none of those things. If you're using BitTorrent for piracy, you're doing it wrong. Bill, what's your response to that?
Well, I was totally with it right up to the last sentence, and then I, you know, it's not clear to me that how many people are using BitTorrent for legitimate versus piracy uses, but I'm sure there's plenty of both. Yeah. There's lots of legitimate uses, but there's plenty of piracy on there. That said, you know, I think that they're making a good argument that they're only the pipes and they're not the facilitator in the same way. It's a technology that can be used in different ways. And, you know, in the spirit of other rules about internet intermediaries, it's not clear to me that they're culpable for the infringement that happens there. You know, you go back to the big cases we've had about what's required to be on the hook as a vicarious infringer, as the middleman. And it's more than just offering the technology.
Right. All right, well, let's move off the copyright stuff and entertainment stuff and move into the world of privacy and specifically the EU. So Google recently won a round in a case that was pending before the EU involving various persons in Spain, I believe, who wanted links to personal information about them removed from Google search results, specifically in the Wall Street Journal article that I read on this. A doctor in Spain who didn't like the fact that he was sued for malpractice once upon a time, and there was a news article about that came up in search results about him. What the court decided, the EU court decided, was that the law as it stands in the EU right now does not require that Google remove links like that, but that law is very much in flux. And under the new rules, which are being proposed with the whole right to be forgotten built in, the outcome in this kind of case might be different. Bill, are you paying attention to all of this?
Yeah, I have been. The right to be forgotten debate has taken on a really central place in the debate in Europe about where they're going with privacy next. And it was always a long shot to have this suggestion that this case is about, that we didn't need to, you know, you didn't need to have a new European regulation passed to create a right to be forgotten. It was already there in the old 1995 EU directive that's still in force. You know, that was never that plausible. And this ruling, although it's not a final ruling, it's not actually binding, but It's from the Advocate General, which basically means it's really strong advice to the court about what they'll do, and the court's likely to go along with this. But so it would say, no, there's not a right to be forgotten now in Europe. It's something that maybe would pass in the future. So I think it could change the politics of the debate about whether they should pass it, because it sort of, once the decision's final, it will clear up any ambiguity about whether there already is a right to be forgotten. It'll make it clear that if they want to go that way, they have to pass a new rule. You know, that said, everything I'm hearing suggests that this whole rewrite of the privacy rules in Europe is in trouble, and time is running out before the next European election. So it might be that none of it will actually happen yet.
Evan, earlier in these proceedings in 2011, one of the lawyers for one of the parties argued or told Spain's data protection regulator that they hadn't asked the newspaper that had this article about the doctor's malpractice case. They hadn't asked the newspaper to remove that because of the newspaper's right to publish, and that would be protected under Spanish law, but that shouldn't be extended to Google. What do you think about this notion that publishers can publish, but others can't point to what's published?
I think that might be actually a sensible way of resolving this problem here. You know, we've enjoyed, and of course, the only way that I can think about it and really articulate it is in terms of the First Amendment. And this, of course, is Europe, and so it's not the First Amendment. But there are, I think it's undeniable that these are free speech issues and public policy questions that go to, you know, the flow of information and the interests that we have in learning and communicating and knowledge being out there. So, you know, what technology is doing for us here is permitting us to live in a society where, as Jay Rosen says, you know, the web is the end of forgetting because of the way that digital technology works. Stuff is out there. It could be an indiscretion from early in your life that could still be with you when you're 85 years old because of the quickness with which the information can be retrieved. So historically, we've enjoyed the obscurity that comes about through the passage of time, the fading of human memories, the disintegration of the celluloid paper on which news stories are printed. But, you know, the technology now is affording us these new ways of searching and retrieval of information that make it to where it's a difference in kind. So if we're going to recognize that the shift has affected us in that way, one way of solving the problem of harm to the individual that comes about through information that he or she doesn't want to be available about his or herself, him or her, whatever, you know, years later, is, you know, you go to the source that is allowing for this search to happen. You don't do away then with the original publication, which has been around, or, you know, which is a very established right to publish. But to solve the problem, it makes perfect sense to go to the information location tool like this. And so I'm not so convinced that it's a bad idea to put restrictions or to put regulations in place that would obligate search information or information location tools to do away with certain information after a while, particularly. I guess it would probably be a threshold that would have to be met if there is actual reputational or dignitary harm to the individual to whom it pertains. You know, so I guess I'm looking at the overall question of whether there should be a right to be forgotten, and I'm not so sure there shouldn't be a right, and it might be sensible to put the onus on the search platforms.
Well, again, this is kind of like asking us about bankruptcy law when we're not bankruptcy lawyers, but assuming that in the EU they have sufficient defamation laws on the books and that those are readily acted upon, I don't think I agree. I think if there's something wrong with the newspaper article about you or information that comes up in the search results, if it's untrue and inaccurate and scurrilous in some way, your recourse should be to go after it under a defamation kind of framework. What do you think, Jeff?
Denise, I'm going to side with you on that one because I'm going to open by saying I'm just amazed that Google won anything in Europe. I track the company closely, and basically the European companies and countries hate Google and look at it as an American company to tax. I don't like what some of Google does, but the bigger danger with your saying, Evan, is it's going to encourage them to also expand their copyright policies. You see what the Germans are doing. It's like if you link to anything, that's copyright infringement. I mean, this is all half-baked, and it's sort of a backdoor tax on American tech companies to subsidize European newspapers, and I think that's ludicrous. So I think if any sort of, you know, right to delete from search engines is just a slippery slope. Anything that attacks linking, which is the basic architecture of the web, is trouble. I think defamation's a much better way to go. That said, and not to completely flip over, but I am with the Europeans a bit on the notion of data protection and privacy and how to be forgotten some of that stuff, because many people in Europe, you know, have a grandparent who lived under a secret police that had mass records of what you did, where you shopped, who you were with. And in America, we seem quite cavalier about, you know, sure, let Facebook compile my, you know, Walgreens purchases with my internet searching habits and put that all in one warehouse. So I think there's a middle ground here. I hope that wasn't too all over the place, but I think European privacy worries are legitimate, but I think this particular remedy is wrong, and I'm glad the EU court decided the way it did.
Okay, let's let our law professor, Evan, unless you want to jump in and respond to any of that.
No, let's hear what Bill has to say. I mean, I
okay. Bill, let's give you the last word on this.
Yeah, sorry, Evan, but I got to join the gang against you here. It might be different when you're talking about data held in databases rather than stuff that's added to public discourse, right? So like the Fair Credit Reporting Act here in the U.S. is a little bit of a form of a right to be forgotten. It regulates how we use certain kinds of credit information, but it's this narrow segment of the world, and it's these private records that are used to make decisions about you. But when we're talking about, you know, I mean, Google pointing to something is the same as a blog sort of talking about and then linking to something is this, I mean, it the slippery slope that Jeff talked about really troubles me as well. So I think you could make a separation between kind of regulating data mining and database maintenance like the Fair Credit Reporting Act does and this other stuff. But if a right to be forgotten ever extended to where Google was taking stuff down, I think it would be a speech problem. And also, by the way, it would be a real problem for open fora and algorithms like Google's, right? I mean, you have to keep responding. I mean, DMCA requests are difficult enough. You'd be adding a whole other layer of takedown requests to your life, which I think would be troubling.
I guess I have three points that I'd want to make. I know there are three of them, so I hope I can remember them as I'm going through. I mean, the first one is, first of all, it's difficult to hold, at least under U.S. law, at least in the Seventh Circuit. So I don't know what the global, you know, stance on this would be, but it's difficult to hold information location tools liable for the defamation that somebody else has published. I mean, you got Section 230. There's all kinds of case law in Google's favor, and there's actually the reason I was talking about the Seventh Circuit, there's this case called Blockowitz that dealt with the ripoff report. And an injunction against the publication of defamatory content, the court held that did not apply to ripoff report because it didn't have anything to do with, you know, the alleged or with the content that was held to be defamatory. So it seems like Google could avoid liability for and not have to listen to an injunction to have it taken down, assuming that defamation law was, you know, that the aggrieved party was able to take down that content, or at least order that it be taken down. You see the point I'm trying to make? There, it's defamation law is not going to be sufficient in protecting aggrieved parties for this. So I don't think that if we're really going to solve this problem of false content, harmful content being put on the web without some mandate that it be taken down, we're not going to solve the problem. The second
I don't want to make you forget your other two points, really, but just wondering if that's just a cache or mirroring issue. You know, if the original content's taken down, how does that not solve the problem, except for to the extent it's going to live on in cache for a while?
Well, why would, Google wouldn't have to take it down. I mean, there's like, with this ripoff report case, the Blockowitz case from the Seventh Circuit, ripoff report didn't have to take the content down. It was, there's defamatory content that lives on the internet that a court found to be defamatory that didn't have to be taken down in the first place. And ripoff report avoided the scope of the injunction, didn't have to listen to a court, a district court telling it, hey, take that content down because it's defamatory. The Seventh Circuit affirmed that it wasn't within the scope of the injunction under Rule 65. So that's both a problem that goes to the web publisher, the host, the website operator, and it by extension would extend even more easily, I would think, to an information location tool like Google. So without some kind of requirement that says bad content must be taken down and made unavailable, that seems like that's that immunity afforded by Section 230 would allow it to continue to exist. So my other two points are quicker. Maybe they're less subtle. The second is, are we going to live in a society where we're just not willing to forgive people and forget and move on if they do dumb stuff when they're young and it's still chasing them 50, 60, 70 years later? Is that the kind of world we want to live in, where we have the right to know scurrilous things about people that they did many years ago? And the third point would be, how is this going to protect somebody who's the victim of identity theft or some kind of hack or whatever, where information that is not necessarily defamatory about them, but is embarrassing, and it's just stuff you wouldn't want the world to know. Somebody could access that information without authorization, make it available on the web, and we have no way of getting it taken down. That's not the kind of world that I would want to live in either. And so that's why I would want to see something, some acknowledgement that, yes, there should be a right to be forgotten, and that primarily should involve the person who to whom that information pertains and who wants to be forgotten. So,
yeah, I get what you're saying. I'm going to jump in with one thing and then go to Jeff, I think, who's jumping in too. And that is, I want to live in the world where I can do research on the doctor, and if he's been sued for malpractice, know that before I go and get treated.
Sure. And that's different. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about information that is false and that is legally held to not belong on the web, or is happened a long, long time ago and is so long ago and the person has changed and it no longer is relevant, or if it's just something that's not illegal, but you just don't want it out there. Right. Those are the situations that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, we live in a second chance society, so I am with you a bit on that, Evan. Ironically, though, do you know who has the best chance of solving this? Is wealthy people in America. There's a Must Read New York Magazine on what to do about this Google problem. Even if you haven't been defamed, if there's stuff you don't want out there, there's these boutique kind of PR firms that do kind of black hat search. To they don't scrub the content, but they surround it with more positive comment and push it down and down Google until the original ugly stuff doesn't appear. So, it's sort of funny. There are other options out there, but they're somewhat shady and they seem to be reserved. Apparently, the service costs like $100,000 or something.
Yeah, I've heard of several services like that. I had not heard that they were quite that pricey.
It depends.
Yes. Lest I forget, as we discuss the right to be forgotten here, to drop in another MCLE passphrase for the show. I think scurrilous is going to be one of our drinking words for the show today. We've said it over and over again, so let's just make it a passphrase.
Yeah, it's fun to say when you're drinking, too. Scurrilous.
Exactly. Scurrilous. All right. Let us move on to an interesting story that Jeff wrote up in the patent world. I have real mixed feelings about this one, Jeff, because while I, like you, fear the slippery slope of overbroad patents, I despise pre-roll ads. So if some little company is going to sue everyone that runs pre-rolls, I'm kind of on board with that in a facetious way. Why don't you tell us about Ultramershal and the decision about their patent?
Okay, this is one of these sort of perennial patent stories that just won't die. It's kind of like a Tenenbaum. Hasn't that story been around for like 6 years and it keeps coming back?
At least.
Yes. Ultramershal is the same sort of idea. It's yet another stupid patent from the kind of apex of the bad patent era. You know, it came out the same. The patent was issued around the time that, like, the peanut butter jam sandwich patent and the swing on swing patent came out. Anyways, so, you know, it's I think the court in district court in California said this is stupid. It's not patentable because it's too abstract, and it's just the idea of putting advertising before content is too abstract. Threw it out. Went to the federal circuit, where, of course, you know, some people say that court's gone rogue because it's staffed by people who seem to have an interest in perpetuating these crazy patents. This is just me speaking. It's actually kind of a narrow technical issue. It's the notion of patentable subject matter, and there's been a lot of action on this front lately. The Supreme Court on genetics ruled that isolating genes is not patentable subject matter. That there's, you know, these other categories. What are they? You can't patent laws of nature. There's a few things like that. You can't patent an abstract idea. Anyways, the pre-roll, the judge actually said, on the internet, if it's on the internet, you know that darn internet thing, this is new and different. So they said, yes, that is patentable, and kicked it back down to the California District Court to rule on. They didn't preclude the court finding it being obvious or anticipated, but here we go all over again. And it's just a lot of money sloshing through the patent circuit. And this particular patent lives another day.
All right. Well, thank you for the update on that. I think I'm going to move into our tip and resource of the week. Our tip comes courtesy of the Paula Deen scandal. Talk about scurrilous. We have seen unfolding over the last few days here. Paula Deen, a cooking show host who has lost her job over allegedly racial slurs that she made. So there's all that going on. But what you might not have noticed in the midst of the reporting around that is the fact that the lawyers for the other side, the people suing Paula Deen, we're treating Twitter more like it was a locker room than a town square. So that's our tip. Don't be doing that if you're a lawyer in particular and you're talking about the litigant on the other side, because now Paula Deen's lawyers are moving that they be disqualified. And so the whole exchange between the plaintiff's lawyer here is he's just kind of being a little braggy, kind of wanting to let people know that he was involved in this high-profile case. He his friend tweets at him, "How you doing? I like your new avatar." And he responds, "I've been doing Paula Deen in a strongly metaphorical sense." And they have an exchange about that.
That's so hot, by the way. Yeah, isn't that hot? All right, go on.
So they have this. The guy, you know, much like you would expect, didn't quite understand what he was talking about. And he had to be more clear that, yes, I'm representing the plaintiffs in this case. And then he's, you know, again, kind of being a little cocky and a little braggy, says, "No, I plan on addressing her metaphorically." And then he, you know, once this all got public and motion to disqualify was filed, he deleted his Twitter account. So, you know, just bear in mind, you might be chatting with a friend and trying to do a little blowing of your own horn, but it's all out there in the public.
As you might say, he Alec Baldwin'd his Twitter account. Did you see that? The last, you know, this is the second time that Alec Baldwin has had to delete his Twitter account because he was mad at some journalist in England. I don't know if you saw that, but it's been the last.
No, I didn't see it, but yeah. So we have a new verb, Baldwinning.
Yeah.
When you mess up and have to delete your account. So don't be Baldwinning out there, people. And then our resource of the week, I'm hoping we have time to play the whole thing through. And Alex, I'm going to, in the studio, leave that to you. It's about 5 minutes long. And we can comment over it perhaps while it runs. But you guys remember Copyright School that YouTube did a while back, a few years back, was sort of a kind of a lame attempt at educating people about fair use and the DMCA and notice and takedown procedures. Well, thank goodness, Fred Von Lohman has stepped in and has some puppets that are helping him, Glove and Boots, to make finally a usefully educational copyright video about fair use and takedowns on YouTube. Go for it, Alex.
Watching this, probably you're having problems with your video getting taken down, or you think someone else uploaded your video.
Bubba, Stop the video!
Mario, we can't stop. YouTube hired us to make this video.
But video is being stolen and re-uploaded right now!
Here we are on YouTube, where everybody's uploading videos. If you create original content, you're protected by copyright. If you upload content you took from someone else, they're protected by copyright.
Yeah? Well, copyright is not
I think the Brooklyn accent really adds something to the educational nature here.
I'm going to tell the big wigs of YouTube that we should be fired.
You know there's links on this page that could help you, right? You don't have to watch this.
Friends. There he is. YouTube's bigwig copyright lawyer.
Some jerk face has stolen a copyright video. Fire me, friend!
Mario, don't panic. YouTube has a copyright takedown process to protect content owners. If your original work is uploaded by someone else without permission, you can send us a copyright infringement notice and we'll take care of it.
I'm gonna take you down! This is a takedown notification.
This video is no longer available due to a copyright claim by Golden Boots.
Curtis!
I love that that's what the infringer looks like.
Problem solved. And now for something amazing that has nothing to do with what we've been talking about. Hooray! What's your problem? I know it's your video. That's why we paid you for a license to use it. Don't spill it out. Don't do that.
This video contains content from Gorilla, who has blocked it on copyright goals.
What the hell is that?
So already we're getting like much more nuanced than the prior video was.
What?
Even with the Punch and Judy slapstick.
Yes.
Fred, we showed Gorilla's video and this head blocked it. Fire me!
That's the content ID head. He's just doing his job.
He hates me!
He doesn't hate you, Mario. Content ID is triggered automatically when a YouTube video includes audio or video that's been claimed by another copyright owner.
Crap.
Well, in this case, I think you're fine. I think we gave you money to clear the rights to that video. If so, you can file a dispute.
Did we give Gorilla money for his video, Fafa?
Yeah, I did! I swear!
Okay, we're good. What is dispute?
A dispute is a way to challenge the accuracy of a Content ID match. You can learn more about it and start the process in your YouTube video manager.
I don't understand.
Well, there's two ways that a video can get blocked or taken down for copyright reasons on YouTube. One is a takedown notice. The other one is a Content ID match.
Wait, aren't those the same thing?
No, they're not the same thing. If you want to know more, read this article before you go to your video manager.
This is boring.
Yeah, I know.
The video is the worst.
This video is doing great. People are re-uploading it everywhere. Next to review video. Why is video doing so great?
Reason A, Tiny Sumo Man.
Reason B, picture.
I think this video is crappy. Look at that crappy red guy. He's not even wearing any pants.
Crappy? He cannot say that I am crappy. I will take down notification his video.
Mario, that's his video. He'll just send you a counter notification. Copyright don't work like that.
This is not fair.
Nope. This is fair use.
Love that line.
Copyright has a concept called fair use that allows people to comment on or remix or criticize your video.
Screw fair use. I'm sending him a takedown notification anyway.
No, wait.
This is the best part.
Yes.
Hey, Fred, I want to take down a video that is making fun of me.
Mario, you can't go around censoring people who are commenting on or criticizing your video. Copyright law leaves room for commentary, criticism, parody, and other transformative uses. You can get in a lot of trouble for ignoring that.
They should have put the puppet in Google Glass in the bathroom.
I am putting it in the video. This video is getting amazing.
But the video's over. All we gotta do is tell people there are links down there to help them.
But what about all that footage we shot before this video got all preachy and boring? That was amazing! Mm-hmm. Now let's show the scene where the T-Rex eats the lawyer on the toilet!
from Jurassic Park? We can't show that. You didn't learn anything.
Shut up! Kill Jurassic Park! This video is no longer available due to the copyright claim by the people who own the footage of the T-Rex eating the lawyer while the lawyer's sitting on the toilet. Fred! Fred! Is this a nap pod?
Fred! I love that they end with Fred in the nap pod.
Yes. Fred! Trying to ignore the pesky client.
So, bravo, YouTube. Very well done. Very educational. hit all the important subjects and hit them well pointed out the various things that can happen. So that was really, really useful, and I hope you guys thought it was fun.
I want to make a 6-second vine out of the bit where he says, copyright don't work like that. I just want to do that one little chunk and put it up.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
6 seconds only. No.
So that's going to be it for us today, folks. We're so glad that you joined us on This Week in Law. Bill, it's been such a pleasure chatting with you. Good luck at University of Minnesota.
Thanks very much. It was fun.
Anything coming up that you want to let people know about? Something they could come to at the law school? I know it's summer.
Oh, yeah, it's summer. You don't want to come to law school right now.
No.
But check it. Follow me on Twitter. How's that?
That's
I'm
good.
Still tweeting all summer long.
Bill McGev on Twitter. And John Jeff Roberts on Twitter. It's been wonderful chatting with you, too. Thank you so much for all your good work and for joining us today, despite arduous travels that preceded your joining us.
Thanks, Denise. It was a blast. I had a really good time.
I did, too. Evan, it was wonderful chatting with you, too.
Yes, I enjoyed it as well. Enjoyed our conversation. Lots of good stuff. And looking forward to the next time. Thank you.
Me too. Folks, if you too are looking forward to the next time, then you should check us out on Twitter and Facebook and Google+. Evan is Internet Cases on Twitter. I am D Howell there. We have pages for the show on Facebook and Google+ where you can show us what's on your mind. Let us know links and things that you think we should pay attention to program the next show so that you can be a part of it even more than you already are. And you can watch that next show at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC next Friday. And every Friday, that's when we record the show. Or you can find our whole archive of shows at twit.tv/twill and youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. We post all the links to the stories that we discuss during the shows on Delicious. This one will be delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/217. If you're watching us live right now, it's not very well populated. Delicious has been hiccuping a bit this week, but after the show, I'm going to fill it in with all the links. So they'll be there. And we hope that you'll be there the next time we do the show. We look forward to seeing you then. Take care.